Looking for an extraordinary coffee? Look no further than Heartwork Coffee. With 8 years of excellence and proudly roasting in the vibrant city of San Diego, California, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to explore a wide range of single origin and blended coffees to suit your taste preference. On a personal note, co-founder Rob Moran has played in so many bands that have inspired me personally, like Unbroken and Some Girls, for example, and it's been amazing watching Heartwork thrive all these years. The coffee is amazing, and I'm thrilled to support this company. Once again, visit heartworkcoffeebar.com to place an order. That is H-E-A-R-T, work, coffeebar.com. Welcome to the First Ever Podcast. My name is Jeremy Bohm. I am your host. And if this is your first time here, this is a show where I interview artists of all kinds about the first experiences in their art form that led them to where they are today. This is episode 186. And my guest this week is Justin Smith. Where do I start with this guy? He has been in bands like Graf Orlok, Dangers, Ghost Limb, Buyer's Remorse, Death Hymn Number 9, Warm Thoughts. His latest band is called Sweat, and they have a record that just came out on the 15th. It's called Love Child. It came out on Vitriol Records, which also happens to be Justin's record label, and they're about to go on a European tour. It starts on the 21st, which is goddamn tomorrow, in Berlin, and it goes until the 30th, where it ends in Dresden. This band rocks. The people in the band rock. The drummer, his name is Anthony, is also the drummer of Dangers. He was also in Let Live for a period. Justin is in all the bands that I mentioned. And the singer, her name is Tuna. She is like a fixture in the LA punk scene. Everybody knows Tuna. An incredible front person. Do you want to hear what Sweat sounds like before we do this? Let's do that. So there you go. That's Sweat. Super good. Check out that record. And if you're in Europe, go see them on that tour. But this is also was really good timing because Justin just played the last Graf Orlok shows not too long ago. And Graf Orlok was a band that certainly Touche played with a ton. They always had a very good shtick that you would think would maybe age out, but it never did. It was always really, really entertaining. Are you familiar with Graf Orlok? Do you want to hear what Graf Orlok sounds like? Because it's what they described cinema grind, where they implemented movie clips into grindcore, right? You want to hear that.
Oh, were they psychos?
They look like psychos? Is that what they look like? Psychos do not explode when sunlight hits them. I don't give a fuck how crazy they are.
Yeah, that's the vibe. It's very entertaining. I want to let you know, if you're new here, that there is a bonus episode available right now where Justin answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. You can find the link to that in the episode description to find the Patreon, which is patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon. You can subscribe for as little as $3 a month and get access to that bonus episode, plus all of the other bonus content we have going on over there. Radio shows, tour journals, Discord channel, all sorts of fun stuff. It helps support the show. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the show on Spotify, Apple, wherever it is you are listening to this, please do that. Leaving a positive rating and review means the whole world. Also very appreciated. And without further ado, here is my conversation with whom I can only describe as the king of ball busting. It's Justin Smith. Good morning, Justin. How are you, pal?
Good morning, Jeremy. I'm fabulous.
This is I've been looking forward to this since this was scheduled. You're one of my favorite frenemies.
Yeah, we agreed on that once.
Right. You know, I think I know the exact moment when I knew who you were going to be in my life.
This is a villain origin event. You know, like
it was. You probably don't even remember this, but it was. We hardly knew each other. I knew who you were. We had interacted before, but it was early with Touche too. And you were going to help us get on a show or yes. something like that. And you were like, you're like, here's the promoter's number. So like, put it in your iPhone or whatever. And it was like said in this way as it, because like iPhones were still, I guess, relatively new. The yeah. assumption that I would just have an iPhone.
I probably had like a flip phone, something like that. Like,
yeah. So you're like, put it in your iPhone or whatever. I was just like, okay, that's the vibe.
Although our villain arc goes all the way back to some point in Riverside at the park side when you had long straightened hair.
Yeah.
When you were playing with a pizza hardcore band.
Did you say pizza hardcore band? Okay, so this would have been Thriller. Yeah, of course.
Yes. Predated Touche, but yes, I recall those other incidents.
Yeah, for sure. But did something happen at that show that would have created, or you just looked at me and you're like, oh, this fucking
guy. That's when we hit a universal singularity. And at one point in the future, we'd fuck with each other.
Okay, great. I love that. So it's so funny. I don't know that I could completely place the exact city, though I should probably know. But this is what's kind of fun about doing these episodes with people that I've known for a long time, because there's like certain things that I'm not 100% on. Are you an Orange County guy?
Yes.
From the start. Okay. So that would explain that would explain why you're a deep Republican.
Yeah. Don't act like that. I'm a corn-fed orange curtain person. I'm actually just beyond the orange curtain. So the border of LA County is very near me. I'm in Buena Park now, but I'm originally from La Habra, which is right between Whittier and Brea.
When you were growing up, what was the first thing that you connected with musically that felt like it was yours? Maybe not something like your folks were listening to. Do you have siblings? I don't know if I know that.
I have one older brother.
Do you guys have anything in common?
He's an accountant.
Okay.
And he's actually one of the reasons I seriously started playing guitar when I was younger, like in fifth grade, when I started to actually pay attention to it, because he was like a Metallica aficionado.
Okay.
And the first song of any like grit I had to learn was so that he could solo over it.
That's tight. Okay, so music was of an interest. So was there something that you found that was different than what he was into, or were you often like kind of following in his footsteps, whatever he was into? Like, how close are you in age?
4 years. He's older than I am.
Okay, so that's a gap.
We came up like my dad was into Sabbath and Bob Dylan, and my mom was really into the Beach Boys, and everything that she listened to was like basically like K-Earth 101 soul stuff, and you know, like Motown stuff. So I came up on that. So the first, I didn't get into the divergence from my brother and I was from metal and punk, and to me hardcore made sense because it sounded the same but was actually about things.
1,000%.
That's really when I started getting into that. But that was like, the divergence really started with a Metallica tape single, a Sabbath Troon, on the back is Last Crest, Green Hell. And then I got into Misfits. And that's like where it went from there.
Oh, so you were able to recognize, like, was it in the liner notes for the cassette tape to say like originally written by the Misfits? And you were like, what's that? Yeah,
because I used to listen to Mandatory Metallica all the time on KNAC. And they... every weeknight they had like an hour of anything like Metallica ephemera and things like that.
Oh, so that's awesome.
They did that cover and I was like, whoa, this is like fast and cool.
Yeah.
So, and then I rode my bike to the mall and got a tape of that. So
was this like a Sam Goody situation?
Sam Goody. Yes. There you go. Whittier, yeah, yeah. At the Whitwood Mall.
It's so funny. I had a reverse situation of that where I remember seeing Metallica always wearing Misfits shirts. And then when I figured out what that was, I listened to it expecting it to be the hardest, most heaviest thing. Yeah, and I was like, what is this operatic shit?
Well, I call it doo-wop, actually. But it that's what's funny, because the record that I got was Earth AD, which was their hardcore record. Right?
Oh, like, sure. Yeah.
And that was my entrance into that. But I do like the doo-wop-y stuff.
So did you end up following like the thing where you were like, okay, well, what label did this come out on? Like, can I find other stuff on this label? Like, or what sort of path did you take to start discovering other stuff?
I think at the time, at least, so I remember having Collection 1 and Earth AD in fifth or sixth grade. And I listened to it on my Walkman when I walked to school. And then by that connection, I think at the time, like the Live Danzig record was out. So they were like pushing Mother, like the Live Mother video a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
And by way of that, I'd maybe previously gotten into Danzig and then also Samhain. And, okay. And then when I got into junior high, I somehow got like the Minor Threat discography.
Okay.
And that was it.
Yeah. That makes sense. What was the first album that you remember buying yourself, like with your own money?
Oh, I have an answer for, I have a two-prong answer for this.
Let's hear it.
Because I'm gonna answer CD and I'm gonna answer cassette. Or, I'm sorry, I'm gonna answer cassette and then I'm gonna answer LP. Because the first cassette I ever had was Samhain November Coming Fire. And that was like the first one I got, and I thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
And the first LPs that I had, and I bought the three of them at once. I took the bus down to the Bionic in Fullerton.
Okay.
That used to be my spot.
Yeah.
And I got all in one go. I got the double LP of Everything Went Black. I got Rancid self-titled LP.
Oof, yeah.
And I got 4 AM Friday, the Avail LP.
Wow. Avail. Were you just looking at album covers, or did you know what those all were?
I had heard Avail from, I got into a situation, I wouldn't call it a situation, but my life. Was that when I was in junior high and high school, I had a group of friends that were all women that would hang out with at school that were a couple years older than me. And they knew like all the music. So even looking back, I have a mixtape once from one of them. And it has like, aside from Minor Threat, I like never listened to Fugazi. So it had a Fugazi song. It had a Drive Like Jehu song on it. It had like,
oh, wow. Yeah.
All that stuff. And we had gone and seen Avail when I was like, just got into ninth grade or eighth grade or something. And they were the first ones that took me to Coos when I was 14.
Oh, shit. Santa Ana. Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
I had a different kind of view of, despite listening to bands like Earth Crisis and stuff like that, I had a different kind of view of what hardcore could be. And that's in a way how I got into Young Barneers and Born Against and all those bands.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Okay.
That's actually the connection, the Richmond connection, which is connected with Avail.
Right. Man, I still think about Coos every now and again, and I'll look up old photos of it just to kind of like put me back there, in the sense of, I would love to walk in and see it now, just because I'm sure it would look so different to what it looked like to when I was like a teenager.
I saw it last week, actually. It's just a house and they're trying to sell it as like a business front, because originally it was a house, you know, it was just a house, but it was named after what I understand historically was a Chinese restaurant that was next to it or was in the house back in the day.
Oh.
And then Coos, as it stood up to 2000 or 2001, I think it was there for 5 years. It was all the shows were just in the living room. Right. So the building still stands, and that's like why, being from where I am, I'm not that far from there. And that's like the first place I ever played, where I went to shows, all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. I've always, when I really think about it, I'm like, how did this place still exist? You know what I'm saying? Like even at that time, because it was like, was it permitted to be a venue? Probably not. Like, did cops just like kind of not really fuck with it because it was on like a main street, but all those businesses were kind of closed. Like, I think that's probably what made it get away with it for so long.
And it was that house structure that had like a cafe in it, which is a cafe part of Coos Cafe. And then the buildings next to it were all these like just storefronts. So at night, the only houses were like behind it.
Yeah.
I remember the only times that I ever like saw cops come around was when people were parking stupid and blocking things. But I saw some crazy shows there.
Yeah.
And it was all volunteers. It's $5. Like when I was 14, the first show I ever saw there was Promise Ring. And it was like, sick. That show was sick.
Yeah. When Joey Cahill or yes. Ray Harkins, like they'll tell me of certain shows that they saw there. And I'm always just like, Jesus Christ. Like they saw like fucking Bright Eyes there. They saw like the Get Up Kids, like all sorts of stuff like that. What are some other shows that you saw?
I saw The Locust and Treadwell there, which was obscene.
Jesus.
I saw all of the first Weaker Than shows when they toured there.
Oh my God.
The craziest part of that, I've got to tell you this anecdote real fast. Please. Is that the first tour they did was like maybe in 98 or 99 for Left and Leaving. Yeah. I think it was 98 when that came out. And then they came back for Left and Leaving in 2000. So in August of 2000, I went to go see them play. It's in that living room. And there's a part in one of the songs in Fallow where John Case Hampton's like, hey, does anyone know how to play guitar? And all of my friends push me up to the front and just hands me his Ibanez. And I got to like play a solo on one of the songs. So I have a picture somewhere of me playing guitar and John K. Sampson standing from me watching. And then one of me handing it back. And I've like just turned 18.
Oh my God. Cause don't they do that also in the live album? Like where they kind of like, is it that
it's,
same
it's
song?
It's Enrique from Mexico City. Yeah. He does it in the live album. Yeah. That's the song. Dude,
that's the same. Wow. That's wild. They've been doing that since the record
the first
came out.
Tour, yeah. And
oh
that,
my
there's,
God.
There's also some promo stuff for like the Watermark EP.
Yes.
Yeah. Like a picture of him plugging in pedals, and it's from Coos, one of those shows.
Oh shit! Yeah, I used to have the poster for that. It was like one of those obnoxious sized posters where it's like really long, but like only like you know, six inches tall.
I have it. I'm looking at it. I have it right here.
Oh, you have that poster? Yeah. Damn, that's super crazy. I remember like I think Joey, you might have been like Joey saw like fucking Wesley Willis there or something.
Yeah,
too.
He played there. I went and saw him there once. I went to like G Voucher that did all the Crass art. She had like an art exhibit there on a Sunday night, and there were like 20 of us there, and I was 18. I'm just like, this is insane.
Yeah.
But as a side note, speaking about Ray, we probably played together at Coos like 20 times.
At least. Because I definitely I mean, Taken, which was Ray's band, and Curl Up and Die were like the two bands I probably saw the most around that time. And they would always play together, and they would often play at Coos.
There was one time I filled in for the guitar player of Taken, who was coincidentally doing like a history degree. I think it was like UCLA, which at the time I was like, why would someone not play a show and go to school for a history degree? Which is
and
what
here
I got
we are,
in
you,
the end.
You, that's literally your life. Yeah.
We went and played at the Troubadour with Arch Enemy, that like Swedish metal band.
Dude, I was at that show. You played guitar for them at that show?
Yeah, I like filled in and played guitar. And I remember people were like, the show is $12. And they're like, give me back my $4, you assholes. And I was like, yo, I'm just filling in.
Yeah, I do remember there being a divide in the crowd that night where I was like, I don't know the ticket should be on this show.
Yeah, they're like, fuck you, from the crowd.
Oh, that's so good. What was your first concert?
The first big show I ever went to was at the Santa Monica Civic Center Arena.
Yeah.
Maybe in 94, and it was White Zombie and the Melvins.
That's fucking sick.
And then at the time, I was also going to in Whittier, up in Uptown Whittier, which is close to basically the 605. They had this pool hall there. And they would do Saturday matinees. So it'd be like seven local punk bands and like no one was good. But when I was in junior high, I would go there and it was like $5 or something. So there are a lot of those types of shows, but the first big one that I went to the White Zombie one with my brother. And then that Halloween of whatever year that was, either 94, 95, we went and saw White Zombie play in at Irvine Meadows. For like their Halloween show.
Yeah.
And this blows my mind now as I got older and I got it. But the band that opened for them were the Cramps, which is like crazy.
That is so cool. And makes so much sense. Like, you know, say what you will about Rob Zombie's output in these last like 20 years. Like,
wait, are you criticizing Robert Zombie's solo career? White Zombie Records bang. His other shit's like Dracula. Come on.
So good. The first Rob Zombie record I was into, just because it was at least still like a glimmer of White Zombie in it. And I saw Rob Zombie live, which was he had so much stage production. I was like, this is to this day still one of the sickest shows I've ever seen. But you get diminishing returns after that first record.
That's right. Yeah. It's like more industrial and it gets more like comical. Not that it ever wasn't, but his band was good back in the day. They're an actual band, so.
Yeah, Astro Creep 2000 is a record that I still throw on often.
That's it's a hot tracks on that record.
Dude, I'm telling you.
Every now and then, Gorlock would cover More Human Than Human.
Is that true?
And I put the sample on the sampler, but it was funny because it was like in a different key. So like it'd be like, boom, boom. And then when it would come in, it'd be like two steps lower.
Lower, yeah. Do you have it in you to write music like White Zombie? I know you need another band. should we start a really bad bunch of 40-year-olds like, trying to play White Zombie band?
Hot rod themed band.
One of the most commonly asked questions that I get is, where can I get merch printed? Well, I've got an answer for you. It's Anchor Fish Printing. They are a one-stop merch shop, and if you place an order and mention the First Ever Podcast, you will get free shipping on your order to anywhere in the country. My bands have worked with the owner, Michael, for years, and he even printed the First Ever Podcast merch. I wouldn't trust anyone else to do it. They can handle all your merch needs, from clothing to patches to banners, posters, stickers, you name it. And again, mention the First Ever Podcast and get free shipping on your merch order anywhere in the country. So visit anchorfishprinting.com, place your order, mention the podcast, done deal. All right, so listen, there are no shortage of record labels out there. So if I was asked who I think stands out above the rest in quality and consistency, it's Convulse Records. Starting in only 2019, they have been completely unstoppable. You know them from releasing records by Gel, MS Paint, and Military Gun. Well, they've just released two new 7-inches, one by the Tokyo hardcore band The Breath, and the other by Ultras, who features members of World Peace and Fentanyl. You can check out those records, along with all the other top-tier releases, by visiting convulserecords.bandcamp.com. And if you want a personal recommendation, check out the Daisy release, Maximum Blast Super Loud. Past guests of the podcast, great band. Or how about Entry? Their latest 7-inch Exit interview is incredible. And hey, it features Clayton from Touche Amore, and I swear I'm not being biased. Hit up convulserecords.bandcamp.com. You've mentioned your brother wanting you to play guitar so that he could solo. So guitar was your, I'm assuming guitar was your first instrument?
Yes, that is the king's instrument, Jeremy. And the song, as a matter of fact, was Jump in the Fire off of Kill 'Em All. So right. It was like my brother would play the solos on that. And but the songs I initially learned first, because my dad played a little bit of guitar, was House of the Rising Sun. Mm-hmm. Was one.
Sure.
About a famed brothel in New Orleans. And the second one was Puff the Magic Dragon.
All right. What was your first guitar? Like, was it like a Squire Strad situation? What was it?
No, it was a little tiny classical acoustic.
Oh,
which
okay.
My brother and I got when I was maybe six, and my brother got, would have been 10. So he had a bigger one. But my inclination was first to play it left-handed because I'm left-handed. Mm-hmm. And he's also left-handed because both my parents are right-handed though. But they were right-handed guitars. So we would like mess with them. But when we started learning, we learned to play right-handed, which which I am thankful for, because most left-handed guitars suck and they look bad. So yeah.
If you were handed a left-handed guitar though, is it easier for you to play, or are you just so used to playing with your playing right-handed?
Now it's like hardwired into my brain to play right-handed. But
yeah,
and that's because I've been playing for 30 years or something, you know?
Yeah.
But when I would pick one up, I would want to strum with my left hand, which now seems wild to
me. Damn. That's impressive that both you and your brother were like, no, I guess this is just what we have to do. Just was it because of the optics of a left-handed guitar or just because they're more difficult to get? No.
When I started, I was like, really started trying. I was like 10. So
yeah,
I didn't know what any guitars really looked like aside from like Metallica guitars, but
that's true. Yeah.
It was because the stuff that I learned initially or like chords or whatever that my dad would play right-handed. And then those guitars were strung right-handed. So we just played that way.
Yeah.
Which I would trace back to some latent psychological issues of being forced to play right-handed when we're left-handed people.
What was your first like electric guitar?
It was this company called Memphis that made like cheap strats. It was like an all black version of a Strat.
Okay.
And I crushed a lot of cans for that shit back in the day.
Yeah. Sure.
It was $181.50. That's what it cost, I remember.
Damn. Because
I had to, you know, get it. And then the second one I had was an Epiphone Les Paul, like, Sunburst, which was cool. And then I got into, like, the Vipers when I started playing in more metallic stuff. Mostly because they're like a bastardized SG that you could run over and they would still work.
It's funny, when I picture you playing guitar... It's hard to pinpoint what kind of guitar you're holding because you could also strike me as someone who's playing like a PRS or something.
No, that's unconscionable to play a PRS.
Have I ever seen you play with an SG?
Maybe once. I had stolen one from Sven that was in Gorlock, and I used it for a while for Dangerous, but I had a white.
I could see you playing a Les Paul. Does that make more sense?
Since 2015, yeah. I've only played Les Pauls.
Okay.
But before that, I had a white Viper that I used for Gorlock forever that I like bought on the first West Coast tour in like 04, 05 at Apple Music in Portland because there's no sales tax. So I still have it, yeah.
Okay, so how long between you learning how to play guitar and wanting to start a band, like how much time is there and what was the first band?
The first real band I was in was called In Reply, which eventually turned into As Hope Dies.
Yeah.
I started trying to play in bands as early as probably in junior high, like in a talent show, we played some songs. But the first show I ever played, I was 17. And I had really started playing with Adam, that plays drums in Gorlock, when we were 17.
And you two are a package deal for the most part.
Well, we had many a year of riffing. And I don't know. I don't think that I was like good when I started, but we just kept playing and stuff. And I don't know, you build some type of acumen, I suppose, over time.
Yeah, wait, but let's not skip over this. So when you, what was the band that played the talent show? What was that?
Oh, that was just like some random jerks that I was friends with. One of which actually later on, I was in the band Death Hymn Number 9 with.
Oh, so okay.
I think we played a show at The Smell Together once. I think
that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it was Dangerous, Death Hymn, Touche, and one other band. I have it in my book somewhere, but
I was trying to think because I think we played The Smell twice. I just went to The Smell because Boy Genius did a surprise show there,
really?
Which was really, really funny because I think on paper they were like, yeah, this is cool. We're playing the like scummy punk venue without realizing it's actually a dump. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We're like every time the toilet flushed, it would resound so loud throughout the entire building for 45 seconds. So like in the middle of the quietest songs, it would just be like,
oh, it is the smell. It's like it backs up to urine soaked alley.
Like it was very funny where they even made a joke. Yeah, they even kind of made a joke. They're like, this is the shittiest show we've ever played.
This is a mistake. I'm pretty sure that
wait, so, wait. so um What did you play at the talent show?
Oh God.
Cover this songs?
Of course. Yeah. And they're embarrassing, so I don't want to say it.
No, you have to. This the
one is.
Yeah.
And this is no account of something that I like then or like now, but one was a Gutter Mouse song and one was a local band Straight Face song, which, and it wasn't good at all. So
were you just playing guitar?
Yeah. Okay. The dude that I became friends with, his name is Troy. Later on, like, I don't know how old you are, maybe 15 years later, we're in Death End together. And in that band, I embarrassingly played bass, but it was mostly just because I could like injure people with it.
Yeah. Did you have to like wear makeup and stuff? Wasn't that kind of that big vibe?
It's called war paint, Jeremy, but yes. Would you say that to a black metal musician?
Maybe.
Makeup.
you wore makeup in that band, right?
Yeah, it was war paint and lots of fake blood.
Tight. What happened to that band? Are they still together?
No. The band's last show was maybe in like 17 or 18. I played the last show, but I was in it for like 4 years. And then they had limited ambition to do things outside of LA. And at a certain point, I was touring along with other bands and it just made sense to.
Yeah, I remember talking to you about them. It might have even been at The Smell. And you sort of made it seem like, oh, no, for this, I'm just literally a hired gun. Like you didn't really. Did you do any songwriting in that band, or were you just I'm here to play bass?
We did one record together, which was cool because it was a record on Alternative Tentacles. So, and when that came out, we played a lot with Jello and did like the 33 and a third Alternative Tentacles anniversary in San Francisco. It was cool. It's like the story of it, like other bands that I have been in for a long time and no longer am in. It's a story of missed potential. And opportunity.
That's very funny. Wait, so if that was theoretically the first show that you ever played, this talent show.
Oh, yeah. That would have been in like 95.
Do you remember how it felt in any capacity to be on stage? Like, were you someone that ever had stage fright? Were you excited to be up there? And had that changed over time?
I'll tell you two times I've ever only had stage fright.
Hit me.
So actually, as a caveat, every time before I play, I always have to piss, but I don't attribute that to stage fright. That's a precautionary tale. Yes. And then the only two times I was ever really nervous was in 2009. In May of 2009, Ghost Slim played with Propagandhi at the Echoplex. And I was like playing, and this is when Adam was in Ghost Slim also. I was playing, and I look over, and I'm playing a solo. I looked to my left and Chris Hanna is standing there. I was like, oh, hell no. You know, I was nerve wracked. And then a couple months later, I played at my friend Chris Berry, who does Repeater Records with Sub Pop. Played at his wedding and I had to play Here Comes the Sun and In the Airplane Over the Sea as his soon to be wife, Megan, walked out. And I was like, don't fuck this up.
Oh, wow.
Other than that, I'm pretty cool. Like, playing shows is fun.
Did you have a band at this wedding?
No, I was just playing a telly clean.
That's a vibe.
Yeah. And it was, it sounded good, but it was nerve-wracking. It was August of 2009.
Okay, so was In Reply the first band that you recorded with?
Yes.
Okay, because you guys did a split. 7-inch. So it's wild that your first band put out a split.
It wasn't a split 7-inch. It was a split CD.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
With a band called Who's to Blame, which eventually became members of. Oh, what is that band from New Jersey that was like very singing? The drummer had like a Britney Spears mic.
From Autumn to Ashes?
Yes. Yes. It was members later of From Autumn to Ashes. That was a good pull, Jeremy. You picked up on that good. And you know what I was talking about.
I am very, very, very surprised by all of this information.
So we had the first thing we recorded was like a demo and there's like three songs and it was like at a place in La Habra. And they're basically one of those places is like, you have 2 hours to do this whole thing. We're like, okay, you know,
that wasn't like Love Juice Laboratories or something.
No,
right?
That was that, actually that split we recorded at Love Juice, which was our senior year of high school.
Okay.
And then we started playing, because that band existed, In Reply existed before I was in it. And before I was in it, they did like a demo that sounded like Face to Face.
Oh, interesting.
So, and then when I got in, we started playing, they were like shifting a certain direction. I was like into Integrity and Strife. And
was Adam like already in that band?
Yes. Him and my other friend Josh, that was the first bass player at Gorlock, they were already in that band. So I met them through that dude, Troy, that I was in Death Hymn with later.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
So we were juniors in high school. That's where I met them. And I went to a practice and I was like, the fuck's going on here? I started playing with them. And then we wrote some stuff and yeah, we recorded a demo and we played the first show that year. And then when we were seniors, we did that split. And then we eventually changed the name to As Hope Dies and then recorded a couple of records.
So what was recording like for you? Like you
started... it's like Red Light Fear. Initially, it was Red Light Fear. You know, like I would like made me nervous as fuck all the time. Yeah. And the process of the majority of the time that like later, all the Gorlock stuff, the early Ghosts and stuff, and even the Dangerous stuff was with Rolly Ulug, who played bass in Gorlock and his band Teeth. And we were in a band up to 07 called Nuns with Guns.
Yep.
That was Rolly's band. Yep. And then he was also in Dangerous. He's been in another band. He plays in Sweat sometimes. So we would record with him, but Adam and I would have to do the scratch tracks because him and I would record everything. And then I would have to go back. Like, we have to get the drums and I have to go back and do everything on my own. So it was like all the guitar tracks, a bass, and then do my vocal. You know, it wasn't like that nervous of a thing as time went on, but it was like the process was annoying. So when I started in 09, the first time we recorded live and we just did it straight to tape, which is like this Ghostland 10-inch split with the band Fisher, we just did it live. And then from then on, except in extenuating circumstances, I've always just recorded with the drummer and the guitar live and maybe the bass player live. All at once.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I was thinking about your recording history as much as I would know it. And I was trying to think like, have you ever been in a circumstance where you were like going to a producer that's like a name and you were trying to like go for it? Or have you always mostly stuck with friends, which is
producer question mark?
Yeah, exactly. Like, cause you when I think about you, it's like, I think of Rolly and I think about Jack Shirley.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I recorded a few things with
and that's by the way, for people listening, that's not me diminishing Jack Shirley. He's obviously a name. From what you'll probably maybe pick up from this conversation, Graf Orlock and Comadre were like kind of a package deal at some point. It sort of felt that way, and that was obviously Jack Shirley's band, so Justin goes back very far with Jack.
We did not actually, funny thing, so I've recorded with Rolly, with Jack. I recorded one record at the Distillery, which was like old kind of In the Red Records type of stuff. So it was like, didn't even hit a computer. that was a Death Hymn record. But the majority of it, since I didn't record with Jack until 09 with that record that I mentioned. And before that, it was all Rolly. And then various other times I've done stuff with Rolly still. But most of the stuff since 09 has been Jack.
And with going to the same, especially for a band like Gorlock that has like such a specific thing, you know, was it one of those deals where you're like, well, let's just keep going to the people that understand the sound as opposed to like trying to get weird with it and like go to somebody unexpected?
I never had a desire to, because for Ghostland or the stuff that's the most produced, if you will, is the Dangerous stuff, because there's just more little things everywhere.
Yeah.
But the for the most part, like the last Ghostland record we did, we went and we spent like a day and a half recording everything. It was done. You know, it's like I go in knowing generally what I want. The most input that Jack has had as of late has been mostly with the Sweat stuff, just trying to get like a little bit more melodic stuff with the bass and the guitar to go together, because I record all that stuff. And so in that regard, he's produced more of that type of things. But anybody outside, like, I don't really trust anybody, and they know what I want it to sound like.
So yeah,
when I go no, in, I can totally... it really ends up being like an editing thing that we talk about, and it's not so much like a sound. Like when I get the Sweat, this is like the fourth Sweat release about to come out. And when I get that stuff back, I'm just like, it might be like, can you just turn this up a little bit and turn that down? Like the sound is always what I want. And
right.
That being said, the last Gorlock record that came out in June, that end credits one, we did that whole session. Also that Flexi that you mentioned yesterday was part of that same session.
Oh, okay.
And we did that all live together, like guitar, bass, drums. And it's like, might be my favorite recording we ever did.
No, it sounds, it definitely sounds extra good. Yeah. I when I think about a band of yours that feels like it is like your specific vision, your everything, I think about Ghost Limb. That always to me felt like that was like your expression of what you truly, truly, truly wanted to play, because it's like got all of the things that I think about when I think about what your musical background is. Plus you're also the singer, right? So like that
singer.
that also adds to it. So yeah, I guess maybe when I was thinking about that question, I was thinking if like, if was, is there anybody that you would have ever wanted to go to for Ghost Limb, or do you like how you've been doing it all these years?
Like, I don't even know where I would start to find the person.
Like, who does the Propagandhi records for the most part?
Oh, that was like Blasting Room shit. That's Bill Stevenson.
Bill Stevenson, yeah. Would you ever consider wanting to try to like ever do something with like
no,
him?
Because, well, I know that Broadway Calls recorded there.
Yeah.
They enjoyed it. And I know that like the last couple adult contemporary Hot Water Music records were recorded there. they sound great, but they don't sound like I would want one of my bands to sound.
Totally.
You know, like there's a, the thing with Ghosty is that, all right, let me preface this by saying Ghostland started almost like a year after Gorlock started. And the whole thing was that like the music that we used to play back in the day when we were like in high school and stuff was more like a local version of like At the Gates type of shit. Right. And that was like when we were up against like Throwdown, 18 Visions, like that's what was happening at the time.
Yeah.
And then when Gorlock started, it was kind of like an antithesis to that. It was atonal. It was like textural. It was really aggressive and annoying. And Ghostland was kind of like the answer to that, is that I could like write melodic stuff. It's like what I would think a Hot Water Music riff would be, but played heavily mixed with Propagandhi or like Leatherface or like stuff that I liked about just like the voicings. To me, it was always about voicings of the chords. That was really like interesting stuff. But in my brain still, they're like two sides, personality sides in a way. Like Gorlock is the way that I liken it in my brain is that Gorlock is like the sledgehammer and Ghost uses the stiletto. You know what I mean? Like one is pointed and is about certain things. And the other one is like, if people don't know anything about Gorlock, they're like, what the fuck is wrong with these guys? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So they're a bunch of gun nuts.
Do you want to know what my favorite record store is in this entire goddamn country? It's Wanna Hear It Records in Watertown, Massachusetts. You might say to yourself, what do I care? I live in Boise. I live in Fort Worth. I live in Los Angeles. What good does that do me? Well, I'll tell you, they have a fully operational web store that gets updated with incredible secondhand records every Wednesday. I myself have gotten into quite a bit of trouble every time they post what's available online. Not only are they very rare records, they are very reasonably priced. And if you have no interest in secondhand records at all, they also sell new records. And here's the exciting part. Listeners of the show get 10% off their orders. So if you check out, use the code FIRSTEVER, spelled together, one word, spelled out, FIRSTEVER, you get 10% off. And if you spend more than $100, you get free shipping. Head on over to wannahearitrecords.com and follow them on Instagram for updates. Username, wannahearitrecords. As a longtime record collector, I owe so much to distros. One-stop shops for getting the best releases from all my favorite labels in one place. That's where Devil Dog Distro comes in. Based in the UK and leading the charge in aggressive music for record collectors, they're the official home of Triple B, Days, Asian Man, New Morality Zine, Iodine, Maggot Stomp, and they're even kind enough to carry releases from my label, Secret Voice Records. You can get 10% off your order by using the code FIRSTEVER, spelled out FIRSTEVER, at checkout when you visit devildogdistro.com. And if you're in the UK, you get free shipping on orders over £100. And if you're in the EU, you get free shipping on orders over £150. So visit devildogdistro.com and use the code FIRSTEVER to get 10% off your order. What is Sadistic Records? What is that? Is that
a Santa Barbara? I don't know. You know, I honestly, it was like we were probably 17.
Yeah.
At that point. And even the stuff that we did later, we did two records with Undecided out of Florida, which had done As the Sun Sets.
I was always surprised because when I was like, man, who put out the As Hope Dies stuff? And then when I saw it was Undecided, when I think about Undecided, I think I'm like, oh, label from Florida that put out EPs of bands that became much bigger later.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
They're also dicks. I mean, like, we were still pretty young. I mean, that was, I think that first US tour we did, we were 19. So like the first EP that coincidentally Jake Bannon did the artwork for.
Yep.
Was through them. But like, they were like aware that we were stupid and young. And you know, eventually I sent them a letter trying to get out of it. And they're like, fuck you.
Wait, so how did they even come in contact with you guys? Because you're obviously from you're a Southern California thing.
Yeah.
Like a MySpace situation?
Something like that. Because by the time this was at the time we played like Orlando Magic Fest. And we played a lot of those fests. But we were booking all that stuff ourselves. And we were like zero years old. On that first tour, we went and played an Elks Lodge in Metairie outside of in New Orleans. That's the first time I met Brian from Thou when we were 19.
Yeah.
On that tour. So I don't know how that happened, but by the time that we were in Florida, we already like knew them, and they did one LP and one EP, and it was like kind of a shit show because eventually I tried to send them like a legalese letter to get out of it, and they're like, fuck you. I was like, sick. I was like, I will never sign anything ever again. And I didn't.
Yeah.
I never signed shit with anybody after 2001.
Because I didn't realize, I was curious who did the As Hope Dies records. And I saw that Bo Birchall.
Oh, yeah.
Was it the LP? I think it was the LP.
He did both of them, actually. Okay.
And for Bo, people listening who may not realize, that's like he's a member of Seosin, but at that time was also doing, he did like fucking Bronx, he did The Bled. Like,
oh yeah.
And it was all around that same time too.
We met him before Seosin started. So we met him when he was just got into Open Hand, because we would play shows with Open Hand.
Yeah.
And then he did that record. And then I was in another band that was kind of like an East Coast type screamy band that was called, originally was called Isidore Crane, and we recorded with him. So what became Seosin was kind of like a bunch of people, aside from Anthony Green, a bunch of people that were culled from our bands. Because Justin Shikoski, that played second guitar in Seosin, was in As Hope Dies. It wasn't in Reply.
Whoa.
And then one of the guys that plays bass for Seosin, Chris, he was in Isidore Crane, my other band. So like they all got like swiped into that band.
Wow.
There's a recording somewhere of Dave that sang in As Hope Dies singing over the entirity of that first Seosin record, because they're trying it with like more brutal vocals. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Maybe I could find it.
That's something I absolutely want to hear.
Yeah, I'll look.
That's crazy. In my memory too. And it might just be lore that I created myself, but I was like, I remember thinking that everybody from Open Hand quit and started Seosin. Was like a lot of those people in Open Hand too?
It was Bo and Alex, the drummer.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense.
Alex is a great drummer also.
So what was the first tour you ever did? Was it with As Hope Dies?
The first tour, was with As Hope Dies in what I think was 2001, maybe 2002 at the latest, because we did 2 years of like US touring.
Mm-hmm.
The first summer, I have no idea why we did this. because we were stupid. But the first summer we did 2-month-long U.S. tours, like being home for like a week and leaving again.
Like just back to back almost.
Yeah. Yeah. It was ridiculous. And that's actually where I met a lot of the people that later on I still know, like all of
yeah.
them. And then on one of them, we played Hellfest in Syracuse.
Oh, shit.
And then
was
and
that
then
the 2002 next, then?
It was 2002 maybe? And 2003. Yeah. That's what it was. And then the next year, we did like a West Coast tour and we did a US tour with, and we did Hellfest. And then by the time I got back, I was like, we were going to keep touring and stuff. And I'd taken a semester off of school to tour. And then I was like, I don't know, man. So I went back.
When you were doing these tours, was it just you guys by yourselves or were you guys with other bands?
It was always by ourselves.
Wow.
And so, you know, like we were 0 years old and didn't have like smartphones.
Of course. Yeah.
It didn't have phones at all.
Yeah, this is print out MapQuest.
Yeah, vibe. You know what pissed me off is that I would always print out the MapQuest stuff. And then one time, MapQuest like did me wrong so many times that I threw the binder out the window once. And then I went to a Target and bought an Atlas. I'm like, good, we're good now. And I look in the back, I'm like, a week later, it says like MapQuest, made by MapQuest. That's like, we would play a lot with like, that's when like Seven Angels, Seven Plagues was around, a lot of those bands and
yeah
stuff like that,
like you would show up, like, you would get to the Midwest and you would just like hop on a show with a band like that basically.
No, I mean we would book the tours from home, but we ended up knowing a lot of those people.
Yeah okay.
And which probably led to the confusion, which has always been completely wrong, that some of us might be Christian.
Wait, because you played with some of these bands?
Because there were a million Christian hardcore bands at that time.
Yeah.
So like when you end up playing a show, like even if we played Showcase a bunch of times when we were younger, there's always like 3 Christian hardcore bands, which I couldn't understand.
Yeah. I don't know. That's
so just for the record, I have never been a Christian.
Man. So I was trying to think about, because I went to Hellfest 2003. Do you remember anything about that specific year, like where, like who you played up again, like who are you right before, right after, and how?
I do.
I'm just curious now, actually, was Hellfest run properly?
No, is the answer. actually, it was kind of fine. I've definitely played worse festivals in terms of like administration, but the first year we played in like the big tent, but on like a stage facing away from another stage, and while we were playing, Atreyu was playing.
Okay.
And they were like, we would play shows with them here, but that was not very good for us. And then the second time it was cooler because we played a smaller tent. And I think After Us was the first time I ever saw Daughters play. Like they were new then.
Oh,
that's when that first 7-inch came out.
Yes. There's definitely footage from that show. And I am right up front looking like a child because I'm
you.
Like, yeah, I was like 18 years old. I was like 18 years old or something. Wow. Yeah, because I remember there was the small tent and it was pretty, like a short walk to the main stage.
So that stage they played, we played the second year.
Okay.
And then the first year we played like a bigger stage, which is like behind the one that Shai Lude played, which was crazy that year.
Damn.
I think Bane played that big stage on the other side too that year. And the guitar player, his voice is so loud. Which is awesome. He just screams over the amps. Like, I'm not like a Bane fan. I like two songs on that second record, but respect for screaming that loud.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. So what was your first time overseas? What was your first international tour?
It was March, the entire month of March of 2007. And it was in Europe with Gorlach and Comadre.
Oh, wow. Okay. They'd probably been over there.
Both of our first tours.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Eventually, I think they went back one or two other times. And I think Gorlach in total maybe did five Euro tours. But I didn't say this, but it's interesting that Comadre and Gorlach, although we did 4 or 5 or 6 tours together, depending on which you count as tour, we started the same week.
Both
bands started independently. And then within a first year, we were both at the end of our first US tours And ours, for the most part, I think it was 05 in summer, was with Bleeding Kansas. And then we got back, we like drove back ourselves and we're playing on the way back, and we played Fort Ryland in Reno. We got there at like 4 a.m, slept in the living room, and there were a bunch of people sleeping there. We woke up and it was them. And for like the next day, we just like hung out and we played that show. And they're like, yo, we should tour in winter. And that's like how the first tour we did with Camaraderie was.
So that's how you met them too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you guys woke up in the same house and you're like, yo, what's up?
Yeah. I met him on the floor. Aww. I have the date too somewhere, because I sent it to Jack, and he's not a nostalgic person, if you say, but it was I've been burdened with their presence for years after that.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
We eventually had to break up though, because we were too competitive. And the other people that like weren't in Gorlock towards the end were kind of like, didn't get that it's supposed to be funny when you talk shit to people. It's not like you're just mad.
That's not cool.
Which explains why they weren't in the band very long. And why I'm still friends with the other people. So actually, a side note, it's pretty sick because Sweat is going to Europe for 10 days in March. And Jack is going as a second guitar player.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I've barked up Camaraderie's tree probably every...
You?
Yeah, probably like every 3 or 4 years to be like...
I know, he tells me.
Be like, yo, what's up? What's up? What's up, dog? You want to play a show?
He's one of those... I actually tried to talk to him about it too once. I was like, let's do a label, a Vitriol type fest thing.
Yeah.
And you guys could play again. He's like, no.
Yeah.
Which, respect.
Yeah, I'm not gonna stop asking though.
I know. I mean, you've gotten a lot of people to play.
So I'm trying, man.
You are one of the key people to blame when there is some type of international war crime trial for expanding the Screamovers.
Oh my god! So I wanted to ask you random questions about Graf Orlok, just because I don't know that I've ever fully asked you about some of this stuff, or like, no, have you ever had any issues clearing samples?
No, because I've never cleared them.
Yeah, well, okay, you know, have you ever had any issues for not clearing samples?
The only thing I've ever gotten in 20 years the label Visual started in 2009. The only thing I've ever gotten in that whole, I never got anything for Gorlock. I only got one thing that was a cease and desist from the estate of Owen Hart for that LP.
Because the band was called Owen Hart.
Yeah. So they had to change the name of the record, which was Earth Control. Wow. And then they did a 7-inch that was called Dead Wrestler.
That's the most your sense of humor of all time.
It's very good. So the answer is no. I made it 20 years.
Wow.
With like really an ungodly amount of songs that we shouldn't have recorded most of. And there's a lot.
Yeah, well, the reason I thought about it was because in the age of streaming, that stuff is clocked a lot quicker. That's what I was curious of. If like having stuff up on streaming services caused you any grief because of that.
Although, yeah, that since streaming has been a thing, the Gorlock stuff's always been up. But yeah. I think there's enough things kind of under a statute of like satire that we were kind of generally safe because, you know, if there's music over it, if it's like cut up in any way, etc. But no one's ever messed with me about it. The only time I was ever really worried was that we put out this 7-inch that was a Heat themed 7-inch in 2012 called Los Angeles. And it was the day that it came out, like the day the pre-orders went out, it was there's an LA Weekly article like on the front. It said like, oh, the new Graf Orlok EP is all about the movie Heat. Right. So we had three like pre-order covers, and I get an order from like Michael Mann's office. And I was the jig is up. I'm fucked. And I look it up and it says address. It's his actual office. And I was like, I wait and I send out all of the pre-orders. And then I wrote a note. I'd be like, we just really like your movie. I mean, it was 17 years later.
Yeah.
There has to be some kid somewhere.
Ever hear?
No, I never heard about it again. There has to be some kid somewhere that, like, you know, maybe saw Heat because of it. So that's a plus for him.
He also strikes me as someone that would just be down.
I mean, apparently, yeah, it's good. Which was good for me because I don't want to be like sued.
So also for people who don't maybe realize this, the artwork for that Heat 7-inch you guys shot with real bullets.
Yeah, there were 1,600 copies of that first press. And I went out into the desert with my dad and we shot a bunch of bullet holes in them. So there were 22.
How long did that take?
A long time. Because you can only you can only binder clip like so many of them because they're like on cardstock. Yeah. And it was funny, like in a uniquely Germanic way, I was there once and people were like, this one's messed up. And I'm like, oh, there's bullet holes in it. They're like, oh, it's so American. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, you didn't even shoot well. And I'm like, yo, you tried shooting 1600. I'm just like, by the end, I'm like, bop, bop. And they're like, bop, bop. And then I go and do another one, you know?
Yeah.
But that was, I have a picture of that, me and my dad out in the desert doing that. Somewhere.
I think that's what I remember is like maybe when you guys were promoting it, the photo of like you guys like holding guns.
Yeah.
Super funny. Okay, very serious question. Are Graph Orlock shirts better than your records?
You're a son of a bitch, but I'll tell you this much. They are part and parcel of the unique experience one gets in dealing with this band. The artwork, of course, is a thing. And the shirts are always like, canonically, they're a twist on the plot of whatever movie the shirt is about.
Yeah.
So you have like Kali decapitating Short Round, etc. You know what I mean?
Dude, my favorite, which is so heartless, was always the Batman one.
Oh, man. Do you know the story about that?
No.
The Heath Ledger shirt?
What's the story?
Okay. So for those listeners at home, there's a shirt that was made the week that Heath Ledger had released his Mortal Coil with medication. The week that happened, like 4 days later, we had a shirt that was from a comic of Batman with Batman like with his arm out. And then there's a picture of Joker jumping and Adam took it and flipped it upside down. So Joker's like falling down the ground. And then Batman is dumping pills in his mouth. And then the Joker's face was drawn as Heath Ledger. I shit you not. We put that out the week he died. And there was like 60 of them sold to Australia. Like in like 2 days. People ask me about that shit all the time. But yes, that was perhaps the most insensitive thing we've ever done.
Wait, so just so I'm clear though. Did you guys make that and it just he just happened to have died?
No. He died, okay. And then we made it like 2 days later. Shirt.
Okay. Adam made it.
Yeah, Adam designed it.
Yes, I did own that T-shirt, so I am of the heartless.
only giving the masses what they wanted. They wanted that shirt, and someone had to put their finger on the cultural zeitgeist of that.
Yeah,
that was us.
Yeah. You guys, I also love on the Vitriol site, you could look at all the t-shirts you guys designed.
Like,
I like
shirtography.
Yeah, you guys kept track of all that stuff.
As a side note, Adam and I have been in, because the last Ghost in the Record, I put like a pamphlet size, like 30 page book in it about the story of the band. And it's like full color and printed. Adam and I were talking about, like, I hit him up and I was like, yo, let's do like a 12x12 full color book about the story of Gorlock and all the art we didn't use and all the shirts we had and like a list of all the tours, just like go and make it like a history for fun. So that's what I'm going to start working on when I have nothing to do.
That's awesome. I look forward to that. I remember when you flipped through the Dead Horse deluxe book thing that we did and you said, the only thing I'm noticing is how we're going from headliners to openers or something like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That was in reference to the flyers that existed throughout the Touche book where we all of a sudden went from the headlining bands to the openers to not on the shows anymore. Although so good. You have been very gracious to Dangers in particular for taking them on tour.
Yeah, man.
Like right or wrong.
Talk to me about working with Level Playing Records, because I think that that is a very crazy situation for a lot of the screamo heads. But I know that there's a funny end cap to this that I'm curious if you would be willing to talk about on mic.
Oh, there is. I don't know how that started. There was never really the only two labels that Gorlock ever really talked to, and it was just by happenstance, was Black Market Activities, which was Guy from Red Chord, mm-hmm. and was Level Playing. And then everything else that had ever been put out by people that weren't me were our friends.
Totally.
Like the Backpack record was put out by our friend Eric. That was Dude Records. And I don't know how the level playing thing came up, but I think maybe we played with Hot Cross at, mm-hmm. at ABC No Rio.
Okay.
There was something like that. We had played when Gorlock was touring a lot, we had, but that was early on, like that was with Comadre. So we had played, and that's like when we initially met Gospel and those bands. And that conversation started. And there were some of the bands I liked on the label, but it was never like my favorite ilk.
Yeah, you don't strike me as someone who actually cares that much about the screamo genre.
I mean, there are things historically that I've liked, but
totally.
And then we did a record. We did two Gorlock records and one Ghostlum record with him, actually. Like, so it was one Ghostlum CD in 07 he did, and then Robert did the LP in Europe. And then we did Destination Time Yesterday in 06 and Destination Time Tomorrow in 07. The 07 one was a 10-inch for that Comadre tour that we did.
Okay.
Eventually, here and there, some colors came up I'd never seen before. And I was curious about that. But that being said, I'm not pointing any fingers. But at the end, I think I owed Greg a bunch of money because I kept asking for him to mail stuff to me. I'm like, we need like I'll mail you 50. I'm like, I need more. Because we were playing all the time.
Yeah.
And that was when people used to buy records. Like at the end, he kind of like disappeared and he just like told Rev to destroy everything he had. And
this is the story that I like. And this is the coolest. Yeah.
I had a bunch of stuff there that I went and grabbed because I had CDs and LPs and 10 inches. And I'm not going to like let that shit get thrown in the trash, you know?
Yeah.
Because anytime we ever worked with anybody else that wasn't us, we did all of the work and then someone just paid for it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I mean, like, let's be honest, crazy layouts. Most labels are a bank from yes. most bands. Yeah.
Correct. And then the rest of the stuff got thrown away in the dumpster. And I went and took it all and sold it in a distro on tour.
That's the part that that's my favorite part where it was like the lore that I always remember was that Level Playing basically folded, called Rev and said, yo, just throw all of our stuff in the trash. And then you pulled up like a pickup truck and just put it all in your truck.
My van. And then I put it. Yeah. I'll say it was out of the trash so that no one is legally obligated.
Did you, is the lore that's maybe added to this that you then used whatever funds from that to then fund the next Graf Orlock thing or something like that?
No, I never, like, off the distro stuff, you can never sell any of those things for more than like a dollar in a distro anyways. So
that's
right. But the reason that I started the label was because Level Playing folded.
So, hey, you know, blessing and a curse.
We were talking about doing the Destination Time Today LP and the Ghostlim 10-inch with Fisher. And that was at the beginning of 09 because we had like a month-long Euro tour in summer. And he was just like disappeared. And he's like, I just heard he's gone. He's not doing it anymore. Not responding to anybody. We have this like, we need to put these records out. So I started the label. So that 1 and 2 are those records.
So yeah, let's talk about you doing Vitriol. Like what, I mean, because you've done such expansive, interesting, like art, I like with getting stuff made, it seems like you and Adam had to really come up with clever ways to get things done. Like I think about like the Doom box, for example. Where does the process start with that? And like, do you have manufacturers that you've come to trust to get that stuff done? Or is it always kind of a learning experience every single time?
Generally now we have like a system, but back in the day, like with the chest burster and the face hugger, that was done by like a company called Thingmakers in Portland that has since, or Tacoma that has since like closed.
Oh, that's too
the
bad.
Doom box actually is, I print most of my stuff with pirates. So, and they are really good about like, we've done a lot of die cut stuff. Even that last Gorlock 7-inch was die cut with like the burning and stuff. So for them, I mean, to some degree, people see that stuff, you know, and they're like, where'd you print that? Where'd you press that? The Doom box was a thing that, the origin of a lot of the Gorlock stuff is like coming up with a stupid idea and then seeing if it could like work.
Yeah.
There were even for that book that I mentioned, there's some ideas that like, cause we had one, the Destination Time Today is with Crosshairs and like, it folds out with all these people that were assassinated. And there was supposed to be a CD version of that that we tried to talk about. That would be, it was like a sniper rifle that Adam had taken a prop picture of. And then it was going to fold out in this really long digipack. And at the very end, you open like the last part, like a Hallmark card, and it goes like makes a gunshot sound. But it was prohibitively expensive. The chest burster and the face hugger were models that we got online and Adam painted them, took pictures of them. They're like real things, like
yeah.
That we made like the other stuff. We'd always take pictures of things and put them together, and so it's like stupid idea, and then kind of happened with the Doom box. We had I don't even know how the idea came up, but it was like I have the like technical drawing. They made like a blank white one and sent it to us. Then they made that, and
I know everything's got. Able to figure out all of the folds to make that work, then to also be able to fit into a 10-inch sleeve is
that's Adam's psychotic, imbalanced nature of
it's crazy. So for people who listen who are listening who are wondering what we're talking about, they Graph Warlock put out a 10-inch that the cover literally folds into a what looks like a boombox.
It's like a 30x10x6. Boombox with like a flap with a discography CD in it and a 10-inch in the front.
It's and so crazy.
My favorite part was the stupid manual that we put in it. It was like everything in it was wrong intentionally. Then there's like a essay in the back about race relations in the 90s in the US.
Oh my God.
Adam, maybe he should get a lot more like respect for that stuff. I think people that know about it like are real into it, and then sometimes people just see it and they don't get what it is, but it's like the amount of work and just the technical prowess to make it happen. I mean, he still works on the new records and helps him with things, and has done every Ghostland record, helps on the Dangerous records. He like does all the label stuff.
So let's talk about Swag real quick. You got a new record coming out yes. soonish. What is it?
It's coming out on the Ides of March, March 13th.
Okay. It's called Love Child.
It's called Love Child.
The band started in what, 2020-ish? 2019?
There's also an origin story about this briefly, is that in maybe 19, beginning of 19, we were going in January and playing, Gorlock had three shows in the Northeast. It's like Providence, Philly and Brooklyn at St. Vitus. Like 2 weeks before we went, Kyle's like, I can't go. Kyle's a singer. And I was like, I can't refund these things because they're cheaper if I didn't get the non-refundable ones. And we never don't go. Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I can't go. And so I called Tuna to see if she wanted to go. And Tuna went. And she sang for those three shows. We didn't say anything to anybody. We just showed up. She sang all these Gorlock songs. We played. It was cool. And we talked about starting a band. Or whatever. And then I got back and I was like, all right, let's start this band because it works.
Yeah. How did the crowd react to Tuna singing? Like, was there confusion when she first started, or were people just like, oh, this just must be what the band is now?
It took like 1 second, then they were like, cool. And then later they're like, are you gonna be on the next record? Like the notable difference is that like right when we normally start, people immediately abuse Kyle.
Right.
And you know, like they were a little bit more hesitant to do that.
Yes.
But then she started pushing them around, which was good.
Yeah.
We got back from that. And then in 19, Anthony, who I played in Dangerous with for like 10 years, I started writing stuff. And then I think we recorded the first 7-inch in January of 2020, and it came out conveniently the week that shutdown happened for COVID.
That is convenient. But no, I mean, something that I think is super cool about the band in general is just how active you guys are with your output, because you've only been a band for a few years, but you now have two LPs, two seven inches and a split seven inch.
It's like the split 7-inch with Negative Blast, the first 7-inch and two LPs.
So, because you guys play a lot of shows too, like, is this a band that you are just kind of always writing with? Like, are you guys actively writing at all times?
The thing that really changed the game for me is that I think in August of like 2020, I guess, when the world was falling apart, Jack in his old studio, before he moved to his new Ultra studio, had this digital board that he used to use. And every time I'd be up there, he'd be like, buy that for me. I'm like, no, where am I going to put it? He's like, buy that. So in August, he's like, I'm coming down to pick up gear. I'm bringing that. I'm going to put it in your garage. And half of my garage is a practice space. There's like drums, everything's always set up. So we brought it down here, and then I like set it up and started learning how to like use Pro Tools, like really. And the whole time during COVID, I was just demoing and writing songs. So like some of the songs on this record, I wrote during COVID.
Oh, wow.
Like, and then I would make like really shitty drum demos, and then Anthony would make them actually good. Or we always work on stuff together, but the crux of it made it, you can go like 100 miles an hour if you have 80% of the song done. So that's basically been the story of the band, is that I've just never stopped writing.
Did you and Tuna have a vision for what this band wanted to be? And have you guys continued with those same influences? Because I've always looked at it as like, oh, it's like kind of like a aggressive Thin Lizzy sort of that sort of vibe.
That's the aim, but no one can counter Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, that's true.
It was that shit that was like where we met in the middle on that. She's in a little bit more like Bonehead shit, but also likes like soul and Motown and all that. And she's really into disco, which I don't hate, but I don't listen to it. And then like on my side, it was like thinking of more of like an aggressive version of like Swami stuff or Wipers, or but like through the lens of hardcore. So there's still like chunky hardcore shit, but it's a more rocker in that way. But yeah, I feel like it's still going. I mean, we just started, we have some other songs that we've been working on for another record, and that's like going that direction.
That's awesome. Well, you guys also have a European tour soon, right?
That's at the end of March. Yes.
At the end of March.
21st through 31st.
Have you guys been over there with this band yet?
No.
First time.
The last time I went was in 19 with Gorlock, and then COVID happened and all that. So I used to go like every year.
Every year, yeah.
In some capacity. And I think this will be my 11th tour over there, but I'm stoked to see. There's been like, people will react really differently to this band than to Gorlock. And I think some of the people that are into the other bands like appreciate it because they can see a little bit of a through line. And other people are just like, oh, I don't want to fuck with that. But I'm quite proud of the way that the songs turned out and like being able to kind of shift in a different direction, but still kind of like write in a style that's your style.
Yeah. No, I can still definitely hear you in this 100%, you know.
Oops.
Well, let me hit you with the last question, which is, when was the first time you felt like you were doing the thing you'd been working so hard towards?
Not yet. No, I would have to say maybe when we really started, like after 07, when we really started like getting around, maybe in like 09, because like Gorlock and Ghost Slim were playing a lot. Dangerous was playing a lot. I got in Dangerous in 08, and we were touring like everywhere. That's like in 08, Gorlock did the first time, he did like Southeast Asia and Australia, and then we were like hitting Japan. You know, it was like infinitely doable to me at that point, which is like, that changes the kind of calculus of how you feel about it.
Yeah.
You feel like you can't do stuff where everything's like a crazy uphill battle, which to some degree, like even booking locally, I've never had a booking agent either,
right,
which is made things difficult after COVID. But I would say then, because that's also when the label started. So it felt like it was getting a lot more esteem, and like people who kind of gave a shit more, paid attention more.
Yeah.
That could be it.
That makes a lot of sense. I appreciate it. This has been great. I knew it would be. thanks so much for doing this, man. It's always great hanging out with you.
Yes, my pleasure.
And that is our show. Thank you so much to Justin for coming on, and thank you for listening. This episode was edited, produced, and made to sound so great by my boy, Ryan Rainbow. What would I do without Ryan? I don't want to have to think about it. Reminder, there's a bonus episode available right now. If you head on over to patreon.com/thefirsteverpatreon or find the link in the episode description where Justin answered questions that were submitted by subscribers. That's it for me. Take care. Be good. Bye-bye.